with 20 decibels of gain of the amplifier itself in order for it to sustain oscillation. The loop gain must be unity or greater in order for it to oscillate. So you could, in theory, choose a very high quality crystal as far as its frequency stability is concerned. Let me drop. Your particular crystal may have extremely good frequency stability, power handling capability, very high Q, which means it's got a very narrow frequency range over which it's going to oscillate, but because that particular crystal has a very large equivalent series resistor inside, on a simple solid state network, which has, let me pick a number, 9 dB of gain, compared to the tube network that you could have used it on, which had 20 decibels of gain, it might not oscillate. On top of that, your transistorized circuit may be creating a different amount of capacitive loading. Each individual crystal produces the correct center frequency at its rated capacitive loading. You'll notice that when you go to any of the crystal manufacturing companies, they'll ask you for a schematic diagram of your particular crystal, or they'll give you a piece of information saying that this crystal will give exactly the right frequency if it's loaded down with 7.5 picofarads from the amplifying network, from the crystal oscillating network. So in order for it to behave the way you want it to, you've got to provide the right amount of gain and the right amount of capacitive loading if that's what the particular crystal wants to see. So the 7,000 to 10,000 ohm equivalent series resistance probably suggests it would work rather well with the right kind of a tube circuit, and maybe it would work well with the right kind of a FET network. Some of these field effect transistors do have very high input impedances, and when properly set up as a Baxter oscillator or whatever, they can have a whole lot of gain, and therefore it would oscillate again. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Exactly. All right. Well, let me shed a little bit more light on the circuits of World War II, the tube technology, and the crystals of the time. Remembering, of course, Dick and I surely had a lot of experience with those circuits of those days. We didn't know much. We started out in this hobby about solid state. In fact, we knew zero at 13 years old. I don't remember. Yeah, I think I heard of a transistor, but that's about it. The besides the 7,000 to 10,000 ohm series resistance, many of the solid state circuits are designed really for 50 ohms of series resistance to begin with. And you got to remember another thing, the tube-designed circuits of World War II especially were designed for what is known as parallel resonant condition. That's the way they worked for all the tube oscillators, the World War II parallel resonant condition. While solid-state circuits are usually of what was known as the series mode type of oscillators. That's the essential difference, and I think that's where the problem shows up, Dick. Over.
And the fact that your crystal was designed for a parallel network and you use it on zeros, series network, as long as you've got enough gain and the right kind of impedances and the right kind of capacitive loading, it's not a showstopper. A parallel designed crystal resonator used in a series designed network, in some cases it will oscillate, but it will not necessarily be on the right frequency. I think when you go from parallel resonance towards series, you end up with a higher frequency of operation. Is that approximately true, Mel? Go ahead.
Please. So you may have to tweak it a little bit, the circuit. Like I say, those crystals have had their day, and I wouldn't get too involved in making anything more complicated than maybe a calibrator with any of those crystals. And in fact, if you insist on using one of those crystals, there's plenty of good old circuits, one-tube circuits, if you want to find a vacuum tube and start playing with power supplies and all the goodies, and just because you want to use those crystals, I mean, it's I guess it's a really just a challenge, but that's about all you're going to find with those crystals, Dick. Many of them just were not at all ever considered for anything other than the equipment of 65 years ago, over.
The very first transmitter I ever built, I think it came out of Popular Electronics, but I'm not sure. This was 1956. It was a one-tube transistorized, one-tube Morse code type transmitter, 25 watts of output, a single 6W6 tube, I think was the tube, which was a beam power audio output tube, which worked very nicely at 7 megacycles. The crystal itself was oscillating with 25 watts coming out of the 6W6 tube. The one tube, when you pressed down the key, you were grounding the cathode of that tube. It completed the circuit, and the oscillation would come out, 25 watts would come out, get coupled to the antenna, and that was the dot or the dash that you're transmitting. And you lifted up the Morse code key, you opened up the cathode, the grid to cathode bias would go so far negative, the thing would instantaneously stop oscillating. And it had a tiny little bit of chirp each time you pressed it down the crystal. Because the crystal oscillator wasn't running continuously. It was starting up on each individual dot or dash that you're transmitting. That was my first transmitter. Worked rather well. CK07, was that the kind of, I may be confusing a transistor model number with the package. The actual crystal holder was about a inch and a quarter high, about three quarters or an inch wide, with two great big pins coming out of the bottom, either two or four screws on the front holding down that metal cover, and inside the crystal was being held between the springs of two metal plates that went down to those metal pins. A very popular crystal holder in those days. A person who was very crafty could take it apart, grind the crystal, and move the frequency up a little bit. What was the model number of that crystal holder that was so popular in those days, Mel? K2KEY?
FT243.
Okay, that's it. FT243. How about that? Over to you, Mel.
Yep, to the man's star. He remembers it. I was going to say 243 was the socket. I built the same rig. It was, the tube was a 6L6, if you remember, Dick. Yeah, it had a little bit of, I could say that, cheap chirp because it pulled, the crystal tab was pulled a little bit when you knocked the key down, but I built that circuit, built it on a wooden chassis. A wooden chassis, power supply salvaged out of a radio that I found in the street when they had power transformers in those days, and radios and a rectifier tube and all kinds of goodies. Yeah, with all that stuff I fooled with, like I say, I'm lucky I'm alive with all that. Those power supplies. And, again, they had their day, and, hey, to me it's all old ancient history, but it's nice if you're a young person, want to get an idea, a little hands-on of what went the previous in the electronics field, I guess, you can experiment around with one of those crystals, and maybe you can find surplus around, maybe an oscillator circuit ready to plug it right in. Okay, well, let me say one more word, and then we'll go on. Okay, as far as, using any of that equipment, I think in today's world, you may get some real comments on the air. So if you're going to use any of those type of circuits and things and get on the air with them, be somewhat cautious because you may get some real unusual comments about, that stuff from those days. And as Dick says, you used to have like a sort of the poor man's VFO to some extent. You take the cover off, the four screws take the crystal apart. Through the cover of the crystal, you would drill a hole and tap it, put in a screw with the head facing the screw facing inward. So it would put pressure, it would take a little pressure off the plate, put a little bit more on that spring plate inside there. And that way, maybe like you can shift the frequency a little bit. Okay, shall we go on?
Yes, start looking for a second question, Mel. and I'm going to say a couple words about crystals. A person new to electronics would say, why in the world are you using a quartz crystal? And the answer is because it does an extremely good job at a moderate price and sometimes a very cheap price of determining the exact frequency of a reference oscillator. In the case of the so-called amateur licenses we used to have, the novice license of the mid-50s, it was a one-year license where the FCC dictated that your transmitter had to be crystal controlled. They didn't trust you to have a variable frequency oscillator for fear that you would make a mistake and tune it out of the band and be transmitting on some commercial frequency instead of a ham radio frequency. So it had to be a crystal controlled transmitter. And these crystals have, in many cases, a Q of numbers like 50,000. That means that the bandwidth divided into the center frequency would be a number like 50,000. That means it's got very narrow frequency of operation, does an extremely good job of determining what frequency your oscillator or your reference oscillator for your phase lock loop is on. Some of the extremely well-made crystal holders that are in a vacuum environment, carefully mounted, can have a Q that approaches 1 million. In other words, you could have an oscillator at 1 megacycle with that Q of 1 million crystal, and it would have a bandwidth of 1 hertz at a center frequency of 1 megacycle. Some of these precision oscillators with an oven connected to them that are used on Hewlett-Packard, among other brands, of frequency counters are really using this kind of technology. Nobody has really found a mechanical resonance device that is much superior to a quartz crystal resonator. Let me drop. The exception to that is rubidium and cesium. These gaseous materials in a much more exotic, much more expensive oscillating circuit do have higher frequency accuracy. That's the good news. But they run at frequencies like 8 gigahertz, and you have to count down from that exact frequency of resonance of those precision devices. So the National Bureau of Standards uses rubidium and cesium frequency reference oscillators, but we amateurs get moderate to a darn good frequency accuracy out of quartz crystal oscillators. And so it's still a very good technology to know about. And most of your frequency counters you can put your hands on these days, the reference oscillator inside, and almost every one of the rigs we're now using with a synthesized local oscillator do have a reference oscillator there referring back to something like a 5 or a 10 megacycle crystal oscillator. K2KEY with the next question. K2RAW in the deck man.
Very good, Dick. It says K2KEY. All right. Here's one I found. A friend of mine, father, was an old-time ham, and he was cleaning up, and he had laying there a old-style dummy load that originally was filled with oil. He said he took it to a place to have the oil removed because it had contained PVC materials. What can I do to revitalize this dummy load? In other words, what oil can I put into it that will be safe today? Okay, what do you fill the dummy loads with today? You know, they had a lot of those cantennas around. I bet you it's one of those cantennas that either Haskett put out, a few others were very popular years ago. If you remember, Dick had a whole bunch of resistors in there paralleled up. Or if I remember, there were a couple of versions. One with a bunch of 2-watt piles of 2-watt resistors. Others had these carborundum type resistors, and also they all were immersed in oil to cool them. What do you put in there today, Dick? Over.
ZCZ with
I'm hearing Hal, but Hal, you're only there 50% of the time. You're apparently in a bad area and you're dropping out right now. In the old day, the oil that was used did contain polyvinyl chlorides, or it also contained, it contained toxic substances, some of the really high quality electrical oils. Also, the oil-filled capacitors, if you happen to poke a hole in one of those by mistake, worry about the oil squirting out of there, because it could contain the toxic substance. I think if you do a Google search on oil-filled dummy loads nowadays, I know there are some designs which work very well with mineral oil. So I think mineral oil makes a very good cooling substance for modern-day dummy loads. Let's see if Hal's in a slightly better location. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
TechNet, K6DPZ on Staten Island. Castor oil and mineral oil work well there.
Okay, you're only there 50% of the time, but I did hear you say that either castor oil or mineral oil will usually do the job. You're going to get a slight difference in dielectric constant between the electrical oil that used to be used in transformers and also oil-filled capacitors and some of the dummy loads. We didn't know about these toxic chemicals that had high-quality General Electric oil in those days. We now know about that, and we now know make sure the stuff is not smeared on your skin where it can slowly be absorbed and give you some grief downrange. So castor oil and mineral oil probably is good enough. K2KEY, what do you think? K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, what I did, I built some years ago, I needed a little bit of a larger dummy load. So I used to fill it, the 2 gallon can. I filled it with transmission fluid, ATF fluid, and I don't think I've had any problems with it. I put plenty of power into it at times. I know I got it cooking a couple of times, pretty hot, but the transmission fluid seems to work fairly well. I understand that they say don't use transmission fluid because it has somewhat of a corrosive component, and I don't know how true or not that is. But transmission oils and motor oil supposedly has some kind of corrosive action. I really don't know whether or not that's true or not, Dick. Over.
And to Leo.
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical of that. Go ahead, Rich. What kind of oil have you used in your dummy load? And there have been people who have done a very successful job of making a dummy load out of a series parallel equivalent setup of light bulbs. 100-watt light bulbs set up just the right way can make a moderately good dummy load where you don't have to worry about oil. Just look at the light coming out of the lights when the transmitter is turned on. Now, that kind of a dummy load does have a slight disadvantage in that it's got a slightly spooky startup characteristic. An incandescent bulb, when it's cold, has less than one-tenth of the normal resistance. So as I said, it's got a slightly spooky startup, but other than that, it can make a very good dummy load. N2EO, the former WB2TCC, K2RAW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
N2EO. Yeah, Hal is right. Mineral oil works very, very well, and it does not corrode. I can say that because I had built a Heathkit Cantenna, which came without the oil in about 1966. It's going back a ways. I was 16 years old, and I got it's a gallon can. I got a gallon of mineral oil at the old Rexall Pharmacy. That's how long ago it is. Rexall is long out of business. And I had that dummy load when I sold it into the 90s. And I can tell you, I opened it up. It looked fine. I loaded an SB200 and a 220 with about 1,100 watts into that thing. Never had a problem, Dick.
Yeah, so some of the modern-day dummy loads have a tapered resistor with a nice exotic mechanical layout inside with a whole lot of heat fins so that they dissipate the kilowatt of energy, so to speak, into the air directly with great big heat-sink fins. That's one approach. Some of the commercially made very high-power dummy loads have a precision-made resistor with water flowing around the resistor, and so you have to turn on a tap where water flows through at the right number of gallons per minute in order to do the cooling. So there's lots of ways of building a dummy load. Another way, as long as you're on a frequency that's friendly, to just to put it into an antenna, particularly at microwave frequencies, and aim the horn straight up in the air. A well-made horn is an extremely good dummy load, and you aim the signal straight up in the air from that horn, and let Mother Nature's universe be the dummy load. That's a very good way. Nice thing about that particular dummy load is you can run key down forever without overheating anything. So when it comes to dissipating power in order to fully test a transmitter and the power supply and whatever, there's lots and lots of ways of doing it. But you got to worry about these old-fashioned oils that had PCB, polychlorinated biphenyls, I think is what PCB stands for. We now know it's a toxic substance. The Pulpig transformers used to be filled with it as a cooling fluid. And if you ever had a mechanical failure of a Pulpig transformer where that oil starts leaking out into the environment, they've got to go through a pretty exotic cleanup procedure to remove the toxicity of where that oil has dripped onto the ground. Do you think we should go through one more, or do you think we got enough for tonight, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Big DPZ with another comment that I think nobody realized.
What's that, Hal?
You go into a couple of light bulbs, you go through an antenna tuner. When your antenna tuner is matched with 50 ohms, the light bulbs could be any impedance, and you have a flat load.
A very good point, except for the slightly spooky startup characteristic. So you can make, if you have to dissipate 600 watts to test your transmitter, then six light bulbs of 100 watts each in the right kind of a series or parallel arrangement fed with your antenna tuner could do the job very nicely. That's a nice way of going. Yeah, I like a kind of dummy load where it doesn't overheat in time. Light bulbs being fed correctly don't overheat. Fins of a properly designed heat sink don't overheat. Water flowing through a dummy load doesn't overheat. Whereas the key antenna, you'll notice that the specification sheet, the owner's manual for the key antenna tells you, yes, you can run a kilowatt into it, but you can only do it for X number of minutes, and then you've got to let it cool down for an hour, because the good news about the bath of oil is that it's got a high amount of specific heat. In other words, as you pour watts into it, watt seconds, which is really joules, the rate at which it's heating up, maybe it's 1 degree Fahrenheit per 10 seconds, so to speak, you're eventually going to arrive at a high temperature. And so you got to worry about that. So I like continuous loads as opposed to intermittent loads if possible. K2KEY for one more. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. So, all right, you've got the antenna or whichever one it is. Mineral oil seems to be the way to go. Okay, reasonably priced, and you'll have yourself a dummy load. As Dick said, don't run your multi-kilowatt amplifier into it too long, because otherwise the cover is going to pop off. Other than that, now you tell me about PVC, oil, Dick. Should have told me about this 60 years ago, because I've sure cooked enough transformers and capacitors leaked out, and, well, maybe that's part of my disease today. That's why I'm sick today, that they can't figure out some of the things I have wrong, you know, because it most likely they don't know anything about those components of those things. All right, I'm looking for one more, all right? Should we take one more?
Roger, Roger.
Okay. Here's a follow-up on one guy with the crystal. All right, we'll take his one more crystal question. He most likely is getting touted by somebody. And they asked him, he says, now, what is a monolithic, he spelled it wrong, it's monolithic, not monolithic, monolithic crystal filter. Okay, would you like to say a few words? Don't get too involved about a monolithic crystal filter, over.
I probably don't know what that is. I hope you do. And if not, we're going to open it up to the net. A monolithic crystal filter. There are some of these circuits where an IF filter network is in a little package with three leads coming out of it, input, ground, and output, and what's inside can do all kinds of magic. Crystals, by the way, are piezoelectric. In other words, you put a voltage on it, it deflects. Or conversely, you deflect it, it generates a voltage. So that's the mechanism by which, when you put it into an oscillator network as the feedback, It is capable of sustaining oscillation. The voltage created by a noise pulse created by your amplifier circuit deflects the crystal. The crystal itself has a mechanical resonance at some particular frequency. You start swinging the swing or ringing the bell, if you know what I mean. And after that, voltage makes deflection, deflection makes voltage, and therefore there is, because of mechanical resonance, the way you set up the actual quartz crystal, it has a very preferred frequency or a series of harmonic preferred frequencies at which it'll sustain a very clearly defined frequency of oscillation. So what is a monolithic crystal filter, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Steve PZ can give you the answer on that too.
Okay, let's Mel try first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, what is a monolithic filter? All right, a monolithic, let me make it as simple as possible. Let's not get too involved in filters again. One of my nightmares. A monolithic crystal has two sets of electrodes that are on the same quartz plate. Dick was talking about the crystals of World War II and all, where we told you open it up, and the quartz element was sandwiched in between two plates and the cover pressed down on the spring. Whereas in a monolithic type of resonator, it is actually two resonators with acoustical mechanical coupling between them. In other words, these plates are actually on each side of this piece of quartz. They're deposited on each part of the quartz. In fact, more than two resonators can be fabricated on the same plate. Many of these are used in receiver technology, and most monolithic crystals are manufactured in the ranges from 5 to 30 megahertz for the fundamental mode, and usually, many times, are also used in what we call the third order mode, will go up to 90 megahertz. Let me think, anything else I can say about it? Relative low cost, and you'll see them mostly with the little wire leads. Popular device today, Dick, over.
And maybe it's an HC6 type of a holder. Hal, K6, Delta Papa Zulu, what is a monolithic crystal resonator or crystal filter? You got it, Hal.
Dick, it's the same thing that Mel said. I was going to explain it the same way. It's a layer of quartz with two plates on the top, one common plate on the bottom. It's what they call a bi-monolithic. But they can also make monolithics with many more sections. It's using one piece of quartz at different, etched at different thicknesses. So he gave you pretty much of the answer that I was going to give on the whole thing.
Could I, in theory, put one of those into a nice small package with three leads coming out of it and use it as sort of an IF can on the IF strip of a radio, a vacuum Hal?
Can. Motorola makes them that way. They use them in their Motrac receivers and Micor receivers. It's a little can, like a crystal, F605. Three leads.
Okay, sounds like fun. I'm looking at, we're going over to the space report now to Paul. I'm looking at, what issue is this? The Association of AARP, Association of Retired People, American Association of Retired People, the May 11th issue, I guess it is, has a nice page describing a number of the NASA spacecraft. One of the nice spacecraft that's going to be launched this particular fall, the update to Spirit and Opportunity, is called Curiosity. It's a Volkswagen-sized vehicle that's going to be deposited on the planet Mars. Or it's going to be shipped from the Earth at on the fall of this particular year, 2011. And I think later in 2012, it's due to land on Mars. And it's going to be doing some very much more elaborate experiments looking for places that did have or now have living capability on Mars. So what's the latest that NASA is doing that you know about, Paul? WS2N, our space person, Q. KQRIW in the Deccan.
Okay, Deccan. If you go to the NASA site and you bring up Curiosity, NASA.gov, you bring up Curiosity, and you could see them building it. I mean, you know, it's like watching paint dry. You know, but once in a while somebody walks by or they do something. Or one time I caught it, and they were working on. They have an identical one that was, they had it in the sand pits, and it was going up and down and moving it around, and that was pretty cool. I caught that one time, and the real one is inside, you know. But you know, when this thing's on a planet, they'll have a duplicate, just like they have with Opportunity and Spirit. They have a duplicate in the big sand pit at JPL in California. So you can bring up Curiosity and have a live camera that you could see what's going on. Let me drop it. Now, tomorrow we do have a space launch at 8:56, almost 9 o'clock in the morning, where the final flight of Endeavour should be going up. This is the one that was canceled a while back, delayed because of the APU problem, you know, the auxiliary power unit. There's three on board, and they weren't getting current to the heaters. They have heaters on board to keep the fuel lines at a proper temperature, and they found a problem for that. It was an open circuit due to a blown fuse in this big box, control box set up, and they changed out the whole control box set. Instead of just a fuse, they changed everything. They also found the problem. Let me drop it. WS2N. Problem was a thermostat that had a little wire, a little hair of a wire sticking out that had shorted, causing that fuse to blow. So that naturally this thermostat was also replaced. So they're good to go for tomorrow. They need the APUs. All three have to be functioning. That's flight rules. When they take off, they only need really one to function. What they do is they handle the hydraulics on board the orbiter. They gimbal the engines for takeoff, and they operate all the flaps. When they're landing, they have hydraulics for the wheels. So a very important part. They've had problems with the APUs many times in the past. So there you go. Mark Kelly will be commanding the flight. He's made famous by his wife, who was shot in Arizona during that melee, Gabrielle Gifford. She will be at the launch tomorrow. She was there about a month ago too, when this whole thing was canceled. So she'll be back, but no, you know, they don't have pictures or anything. It's just when family members go down there, they have private rooms where they go in, and this goes on a lot, where the press don't really get a hold of the family members during lunch if they choose not to. So we'll see how that goes tomorrow, 8:56 a.m. Drop it. You might remember when it was canceled, it was a late afternoon flight. Was as the days go by, what happens is every time there's a delay, there's a drop of, you know, a half hour or so every day. So the flight gets earlier and earlier every time the delay gets to the point where it's too early. They don't have night flights anymore due to the Columbia disaster. They need to have a tremendous amount of photos, cameras on board the orbiter now, and they require daytime flight. The only time they abandoned that idea is when they did the Hubble repair. That was the only nighttime flight. and that was the last one. So when the time gets earlier and earlier, eventually it's too early, and then they have to go a couple of few weeks delay. So that's so much for STS 134. They'll be putting that telescope on board the space station, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. We've talked about that quite a few times on the net. So that'll be going up. It's a big thing. It's like 10 feet by 15 feet by, I don't know, 12 feet high or something. It's like the equivalent of seven small cars. Like you have a couple of Hondas out there. Seven cars, you put them together. That's how heavy this thing is. It's got big magnets in there. They're using superconductivity on these magnets. I read somewhere where it's a couple of thousand gauss or something like that. I think 2,500 gauss, tremendous powerful magnets that they're using on this Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. So they'll attach it permanently to the space station. It's actually going to be attached to the S1 or Starboard 1, this big truss piece that's coming off the center of the space station. And that thing will stay there forever. I mean, it's not one of these things that are going to operate a couple of years. It will stay up there as long as the space station is there. So that's minimum time till 2020. So that's the time left on the space station. Of course, that's going to wind up with many extended years, I'm sure, after that. Dick, I wanted to talk to our 1 minute about the Dawn spacecraft. This is WS2N.
Sounds good. Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Dawn is the... I remember when this thing launched back in 2007. I probably brought it up on the net. But it's closing in on its first destination asteroid called Vista. Actually, really like planetismal. It's almost a small planet. I think it's like 400 miles in diameter or something. So it's the second largest asteroid out there. So it's got to the point where it finally took its first picture. So that's why I brought that up maybe about a week or so ago. And that's how close it's getting. It's going to go into orbit around Vista and stay in orbit for about a year at about 120 mile perigee orbit. And it should stay there 1 year and then deorbit. First time it's going to, any spacecraft will do that. And then it'll go on to the next biggest or biggest asteroid, Cirrus, in 2015, so about 4 years down the road, and then it will go into orbit around that and take pictures and all. So Dawn is it's got all kinds of cameras on board. It's got spectrometers, infrared spectrometers, gamma ray spectrometer, you know, to measure the elements, what's on these asteroids and all. So a lot of science is going to be coming off the these asteroids. Let me drop it. WS2N. Cool thing about Dawn is this is the one with the ion engines. Actually, it has three ion engines. Each engine is about a foot in diameter. I know we've talked about it before, but a lot of people maybe have never heard about this story. It does have an ion engine which fires up and stays on for, like, you know, when you have a space launch and you've got, let's say, the shuttle that goes up, 8 minutes later, it's in orbit, fuel is gone, tanks are completely, separated from the orbiter, 8 minutes of fuel, done, finished. This thing, years and years, the engines don't shut off. I mean, they leave them on forever. That's why they've got these big solar panels sticking out, picking up the electricity, charging the batteries, and then firing off, atoms of xenon, really, and shooting it out the back. And it starts off with like 1,000 pounds of fuel. That's it. That's all it's got. But the speed that's coming out, it's being propelled at, I don't know how many, 30, 70,000 miles an hour, some bizarre number, whatever it is. And creates a little thrust. And they say the thrust is about as much as you take a piece of paper, like a press of paper, put it on your hand. That's how much thrust we're talking about. To push a spacecraft like that, you drop it. Each velocities from, say, 0 to 60. You get in a car, you push the gas down, 6 seconds, 10 seconds later, whatever it is, you're going 60 miles an hour. Well, this is 4 days later. you'll accelerate, you'll change your speed by 60 miles per hour. But they're good. Three engines on board. They don't fire at the same time. One will fire, and then another one will fire. And, they don't, it's not set up like that. It's just, you would see it, you would only see one engine firing at a time. But they're all ganged together. And again, they only shut down like long enough, maybe a couple hours a week, just to reorient the spacecraft, point the antenna to Earth, and communicate with it. So that's about it. That's what I have for Dawn. Good mission to follow. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
So, it's going to be visiting the asteroid Vista and Sirius, I think it is. Land on one and take off and go to the other one and collect information. This page 39 of the May issue of AARP, American Association of Retired People, talks about 10 of NASA's spacecraft that are either in operation or about to go into operation. The Kepler has been in operation now for, I think, almost 2 years. It has found 1,235 new planets going around other stars, and 5 of those planets are very interesting because they seem to be Earth size and Earth temperature. In other words, they're possibly habitable. There's a famous scientist, Dr. Michio Kaku, who is predicting that within the next 50 years, we will find other life in the universe, and it might be intelligent life that is doing something interesting to eavesdrop on. The spacecraft Juno will be launched for a 5-year mission in August. It's going to the planet Jupiter, I think it is, and we'll be making a lot of measurements. The Curiosity we've already talked about. The Messenger spacecraft is the first spacecraft ever put in orbit around Mercury, the planet Mercury, the innermost planet closest to the Sun, and it's making some nice measurements. Multiple unmanned probes in September are going to be launched to the Moon to measure the Moon's atmosphere more accurately with reference to possible future manned missions there. Let me drop. Let's see, the space shuttle will eventually, is almost completed, a 10-year, International Space Station, 10-year construction, going to be used to at least the year 2020, and it's essentially complete in construction, particularly after the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer is installed. That's the one that's got this huge magnet that Paul was telling you about, and that's the world's highest power cosmic ray telescope. And hopefully it doesn't also go into saturation. Every cosmic ray telescope we've ever put up periodically sees an event so powerful that you can't even measure what it was because the detector saturates. And this one is many orders of magnitude stronger in capability without saturation. Alrighty. There's 10 objects here on this page 39, which is good for looking at if you're at all interested in space. Of the questions that Wesley mailed me, The first series of questions begin on the subject of square waves. It's a very interesting project. Let me drop.
Dick and Julio, I have a follow-up on Paul's space report. I just came upstairs. Is that all right?
Yeah, this is okay, 2KEY. Why were the questions?
All righty. We're going to go to N2EO and then take K2KEY in that order. You want to add something to the space report? Go right ahead, Rich.
And one quick correction on the space report, though.
Okay. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I'm sorry to come in so late after the space report. It's just I came upstairs and downstairs. It takes me a while to get upstairs. What I wanted to say is... Paul had mentioned something about space going into private industry getting involved in launching spacecrafts, and I saw something on cable news network about a company called SpaceX, S-P-A-C-E, space, followed by the letter X, and the company has a good, I think has a good track record because the owner of the company is the same guy who started PayPal. And they already had a launch, a test launch, one failed, succeeded. I think Paul knows the name of the rocket. I forget the name of the rocket. But what I wanted to say, Dick, related to space, but not totally, you can go on the internet to spacex.com, get a lot of information. You can sign up for their newsletter. And the reason I bring it up is because... I called them up on the telephone after signing up for their newsletter and getting some information. Turns out they're going public in about a year, I was told by the girl there. And I think it's a company to watch because I think, you know, it's the ground floor. Anybody interested in investing in technology, I think it's a good place. That's my opinion. Let me turn it back to you, Dick, but basically space, the thing is going to go private industry, and SpaceX says they can do it cheaper than the government, and they already have a contract with NASA. Maybe Paul can fill us in on that. Back to you, Dick.
This article I'm telling you about on page 39 talks about SpaceX, and the name of the actual vehicle is called Dragon, D-R-A-G-O-N. And it will be doing the future supply runs to the International Space Station. So we're going from quasi-military or over to a commercial business that's going to be doing it. Mel, you said you had a question? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, when we were talking about, I wanted to ask one more question about, personally, about something about crystals. I thought maybe you could fill me in, but we jumped over to the space report. So I was wondering, is it possible that I could just put that one question in, Dick, over?
Go right ahead with your crystal question.
Okay. If you remember back in all days when people actually listened to phonograph records, they had a crystal cartridge in the phonograph. They always had the crystal cartridge, which was, I believe, based on, if I'm not wrong, the piezo, the piezo effect. If I would have at that time taken my Simpson 260 and put it across the wires that were connected, the two wires that were connected to the cartridge, what would I have seen, Dick? Over.
By the way, that's made of a shell salt, that crystal, K6DPC.
Yeah, both the so-called crystal microphone and the crystal cartridges in the old-fashioned phonograph record players used not quartz, but something, another kind of piezoelectric material. In other words, a material that, when mechanically flexed, produced a voltage. And you would have seen a very interesting voltage coming out of that phonograph cartridge or out of the crystal microphone if you connected it to an oscilloscope. The nice thing about an oscilloscope is that it'll take the millivolts of output from that cartridge, and with enough gain setting on the oscilloscope, you'll see it displayed as a vertical deflection of voltage versus time horizontal on the oscilloscope. If you had connected it to an old-fashioned volt-ohm milliammeter, The average DC voltage out of that crystal would be zero, so you'd see nothing on the DC scales. On the ohm meter scale, I think it would almost be an open circuit, you would see nothing. And the AC scale, because it had a kind of a selenium rectifier in there, when you got down to, let me pick a number, a quarter of a volt or so, it no longer responded. You'll notice that the lowest voltage AC scale on a triplet or Simpson volt ohm milliammeter is very nonlinear, and it can't measure small voltages. A modern day digital voltmeter in the so-called millivolt or microvolt AC region would show you something. But the best way to display it, I think, would have been an oscilloscope. And I bet you owned an oscilloscope at that time, and you could have done that experiment, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I mean, H-O-R-Y.
CPZ, it was Rochelle Salt they made those cartridges out of.
Which is another kind of piezoelectric material, which, by the way, was very moisture sensitive. But Mel first. Go ahead, Mel. And then Joe in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
No, I did not own a oscilloscope when I was 13 years old. Didn't have a meter. Oh, yeah, finally I got myself a meter. I think I described it. I got a 0-1 milliamp meter and made on a piece of wood with Fahnestock clips and resistors and all kinds of things. I made myself a volt meter and a D battery, made myself an ohm meter. I don't remember. I used that meter for so many things that I can't remember now. That was my whole instrument panel. Okay. I was just curious because I never did much with it, but it just happened to jump into my mind. I was wondering if that piezo effect, when you agitate that crystal, if it had any updating in any applications today for generating electric by some stimulus means, but I guess not really. Go ahead, Dick. This is K2KEY.
Yeah, that only made millivolts. So it would take a long time to charge a battery that way by you mechanically moving that cartridge. Joe, you had a question on this one, W-A-2-R-Y-Y?
No, I'm just cutting in to make a statement. You're cut off from the IRLP. You're apparently cut off when you had your nitwit on here before playing the music, unless somebody cut it off on purpose. But you're not connected to anything else, including your machine out east.
Okay, maybe the powers that be have heard that, and maybe they're applying corrective action. Paul, you wanted to give us an update on the space report? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
A6DPZ with a comment.
Paul first, go ahead, Paul.
Very good. Yeah, the Dawn spacecraft is not going to land or send any probes to touch those asteroids. They're just going to orbit and then leave and then orbit again. By the way, the amount of fuel that this thing has is 1,000 pounds, even though it seems like it's a lot less. The total amount of thrust over all these years, many, many years of operation, is more than the Delta rocket that fired it off. It's more than the five strap-on boosters that were attached to it, and it's more than the second stage that put it in deep space.
Welcome to the Live Mobile Amateur Radio Club computer system.
Thrust
takes off on the New England
Link active. To answer Rich's question, the Dragon is the name of the spacecraft, but the rocket, I think he asked about the rocket. The rocket was the Falcon. It's called the Falcon. And he's right. The first one was a failed attempt, but the second one went beautifully. And it's supposed to have more to follow this year. Let me drop it. Demonstration similar to the last one, but that one went so well that it's going to drop that test and they're just going to move on, I think, to eventually develop the thing to dock with the space station for resupplying. The Dragon is going to be multifaceted. It's going to be a cargo ship at first, and eventually we'll be able to ferry six astronauts, actually seven. I have plan on seven astronauts to the space station and back, and that's at least, say, 6 years away from being completely developed. They do have contracts. Each contract was, I think,
a little more than $1 billion. I think they're up to their second or third contract with SpaceX. So the guy's doing good. There's other companies involved too. Orbital Science, they haven't been as successful as these people. I mean, these people launch from Florida and all. Let me drop it. But they've built their own launch facilities, and so they're well on their way. So I'm hoping that things work out. I mean, there is a movement. There is a woman congresswoman down in Texas. I forgot her name, and I believe last week or the week before she had a proposal to really reinstate the Orion Constellation program to have America really bring back that program. The Constellation program was the Ares Orion system where they're going to launch rockets and eventually go back to the moon. So there's still that fire is not completely out yet, but it's pretty dim, no question about it. I wanted to bring that up, Dick, and it sounds like a good article. It sounds like a lot of the topics we've talked about on the net, they've included Kepler, the trips to the moon, Messenger, Juno to Jupiter. Maybe they're listening to the net, Dick. they picked all the topics that we've talked about. Back to you, Dick, WS2I.
Yeah, it's only one page. Let me tell you about 10 of the things that NASA are doing right now, have done or are doing this year. Page 39 of the May issue of American Association of Retired People magazine. And I, being in theory a retired person, although I work every day, I get that magazine. Paul was telling us about a ionic engine and that it has the amount of thrust of a piece of paper resting on your hand. And at first it sounds like, why in the world would you do that? The way you rate the efficiency of a rocket engine is a measurement that's called specific impulse. Just to give you an example of what Newton's third law was telling you, let me drop. Make-believe Arnold Schwarzenegger is floating in free space in the cargo hold of the space shuttle while it's in orbit. So he's in zero gravity. He's in microgravity, as you call it, as you say. Assume he weighs 200 pounds, and in his hand is a 200-pound barbell. And he pushes the barbell 1 meter per second to the north, and his body will move 1 meter per second to the south. Action and reaction. If he pushes harder, so that he's pushing the exact same weight, 2 meters per second to the north, he will move 2 meters per second to the south. So as you can tell, the efficiency of a rocket engine is a function of what is the exhaust velocity. A typical chemical reaction engine, chemical type rocket engine, I'm not sure of the exact number, but maybe the gases come flying out of that nozzle at something like a couple of thousand miles an hour. And you get a certain amount of thrust out of that. In the case of an ion engine, the charged particles come flying out of that engine, very few of them as far as mass is concerned, but they're flying out of there at close to the speed of light, some fraction of the speed of light. So that the advantage of an ionic engine is you use very little fuel, you get very little thrust, but you get an extremely large amount of thrust per gram of fuel that you're exhausting out of the engine. Because you're doing it at a high velocity, you get a lot of overall thrust as long as you've got enough time to integrate that small amount of power for a large amount of time. You eventually accumulate a very large velocity. So it's a very efficient engine, and ion engines are now becoming kind of popular. Let's see now. Hal wanted to give us some more words. K6DPZ, K2RIW. Those were shell salts that you're talking about, Hal. I think when they were made into crystal microphones, they were very humidity sensitive. You could put an old-fashioned crystal microphone in a very high humidity environment, and you might get a failure. K6DPZ, K2RIW. Okay, maybe Hal's not available right now.
I believe you skipped someone.
Yeah, Hal did say he had a comment. And was there someone else that had signed up? Let's see now.
Joe 2T, I believe.
What were those call letters again?
Uh,
was 2T with the last two letters. I believe it's Joe.
You're absolutely right. KG2T. Good. Good people. KG2T. Joe, if we didn't put you to sleep,